Hello and welcome to Book Talk from Scottish Book Trust. I'm Paul Gallagher, and on this month's podcast, the last one of 2012, I'm really pleased to welcome back Ed McCracken from Book Riot and school librarian Rachel McCabe from Holyrood High School. But that's not all. This month, we also have some special guests in the form of Holyrood High School pupils Juliet and Michael. And we're all going to get into a timely discussion over one of the books of the moment, The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. So let's get straight to it. I imagine that The Hobbit, or There and Back Again, to give it its full title, needs no introduction for most, if not all, of our listeners. First published in 1937, it's never been out of print since then, and is, according to my in-depth Wikipedia research, one of the biggest selling books of all time. It's the story of Bilbo Baggins, one of a race of small and incredibly resourceful people called hobbits, who live in a lush green environment called the Shire, and love nothing more than peace, quiet, and home comforts. Bilbo's uneventful existence is interrupted when the wizard Gandalf nominates him as the 14th member of an expedition to the ominous-sounding Lonely Mountain in an attempt to claim back some stolen gold from a dragon called Smaug. The other 13 members of the group are dwarves, cantankerous, battle-loving fellows led by the impressively named Thorin Oakenshield. There follows an adventure that crosses the fantastical land of Middle-earth, taking in encounters with goblins, elves, a man who can transform himself into a bear, and the fearsome dragon himself, amongst many others. The story has been the subject of many adaptations for theatre, radio, and screen over the years, and this Christmas brings the biggest one yet, a big screen, big budget production from Peter Jackson, the man who so successfully brought Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy to the screen about a decade ago. So, we'll maybe talk about our hopes for the film adaptation later, but first, let's get into the book. Ed McCracken, what is it about The Hobbit that so captures readers' imaginations and has caused the book to be so well-loved, seemingly from the moment it was first published?
First and foremost, it's a big book, but in quite a slim volume. I mean, there's a massive world in there, and just over, 300-odd pages is the edition which I have. But within that, you have a really vividly realised, geographically realised, historically realised world. If you're looking at the maps, you kind of get a real sense of where everyone's going. It has a real physicality about it, and it's something which you can easily lose yourself in, as evidenced by the fact that so many people obsess over at least tiny geographical details over it, and historical details. So I think it's quite an accessible, but wonderful world. I mean, you know, essentially it's a fairy story, and fairy stories are the stories which last throughout the ages.
So I'm interested, when did you first read it? Because it is a book that is thought of as a children's book, even though it's read by people of all ages.
I read it in my 33rd year, which was last year. So I very much came to it late. I did want my school librarian to order it when I was in primary school, but they never did. So it meant my first introduction to Middle Earth was actually when I started reading Lord of the Rings in my teenage years, which I loved. And I think it's the right age to kind of read that kind of book. But coming to The Hobbit as I did last year, and when I read it in a day, I mean, it's that kind of book. And I think the way it's written in a very kind of straightforward, kind of almost like historical way, or almost like a fireside kind of camp tale. Yeah. It's very accessible, and you can skim through it so easily, especially the episodic format. I do think it is a kid's book still in the way it's written, compared to Lord of the Rings, which is more complex, it's more political, it's more philosophical. There's various bits in this. For example, the final battle is more like a sketch, whereas in Lord of the Rings it had treated, you know, that to several chapters and discussed all the political ramifications of it. I think it's a kid's book, and that's not to talk it down. I think it's really accessible because of that.
So, Rachel McCabe, before we started recording, you said that you, I think, if I recall correctly, that you've read The Hobbit four times in your life. So I'm guessing that they weren't all in the last year. So I'm guessing this is a book that has perhaps played some part in your reading life. So tell us a bit about your thoughts on The Hobbit.
I was given The Hobbit on my 10th birthday. That was 1972. I read it then in 2 days. I couldn't put it down. I'd never read anything like it. I thought it was wonderful. I liked particularly at the time the fact that, again, it's the little people who win. I really like that. I like that in The Lord of the Rings, the fact that it's the hobbits who prove the most powerful in the end. And I like that in the shape of Bilbo Baggins. And I kept rereading it throughout my teenage years alongside The Lord of the Rings. But I hadn't read it until I picked it up again for this podcast for about 30 years. And it was wonderful going back to it again. It was wonderful. I mean, it took me back to when I first read it. So it took me back to the 70s. But it also took me back to Middle Earth. And I love it. I think it has an awful lot going for it. But I also think it's got a lot of problems for the modern reader, which we'll talk about a bit later on, I think. Okay. But I just loved it. It was a great book.
Fantastic. So to come to younger contributors, Juliet, I'm going to come to you first. Like, you've said that you've never seen the Lord of the Rings films, you've never read Lord of the Rings, so I think the rest of us here sort of know this world from those films as well, but you've read The Hobbit, but that's your only experience of Middle-earth, so what's your response to The Hobbit?
I liked it very much because I'm really into kind of fantasy novels, and I've read quite a few kind of fantasy things. I think the map at the back helped a lot as well, so I could kind of track where they were going, and it was a bit difficult for me to read at first, but I got used to it, and I really became quite attached to the kind of scenery and the kind of the world itself. But I feel I could learn more about it, so I'm planning to read Lord of the Rings soon.
So it's like the creation of a believable world that really grabbed you.
That's what I liked, yeah.
How about you, Michael? What's your take on The Hobbit?
I liked a wide range of all sorts of characters, all sort of different characteristics.
So that's interesting, because here's my take, okay? So we've had very positive views from everyone so far. I'm not saying I didn't like it. I enjoyed it. But, so this is the first time I've read it, I should say. I'm not that far from Ed in age, and I've just read it for the first time in the last week. I found my reaction to it was pretty variable. Like, I loved some bits, and I was a bit bored by other bits. It seemed to me, Ed, I'm going to put this to you, it seems to me that the whole story really hangs on the character of Bilbo. Like, he's a great character to throw into this kind of adventure because he's so incongruous in the setting, and he's so funny, like, at points in his reactions, but he's also the right character, it turns out, to really get this adventure to the place it needs to be. But if it wasn't for him, I think you would notice a lot more that the story doesn't really have much of a focus. I mean, the dwarves don't really have a plan, and nobody in the story really knows what they're doing. Everyone's pretty much making it up as they go along. And compared to Lord of the Rings, where there's a definite take the ring to Mount Doom and destroy it, here there's like, we'd like to get our treasure back, but we don't really know how to. And oh, look, we've met this person. And oh, look, we've met this person.
Yes, I agree. And especially towards the end of the book, because in my mind, all I knew about The Hobbit was basically Bilbo goes and gets, you know, treasure from a dragon, and then they do that, and actually the climactic battle with the dragon isn't actually that climactic. You yes. know, it just happens away from where Bilbo and the dwarves are, and you hear about it almost like as happenstance, and then you have this whole other kind of narrative kind of kicks in, which is very briefly dealt with, but I think it's very interesting. But again, it's not fully realized. But you know, in terms of the episodic nature of things, yes, of course you're going to get, it's like, you know, have a collection of short stories, some you'll really like, some you won't. Mm-hmm. So it'll be variable quality. But you know, Tolkien was very much, you know, he was a scholar in Anglo-Saxon mythology, Norse mythology, and this kind of, these kind of stories were by their nature very episodic, and I think he was drawing upon that kind of tradition and narrative, and that kind of really shone through in The Hobbit, probably more so than in Lord of the Rings, where he was more confident in Lord of the Rings mm-hmm. as a storyteller, whereas The Hobbit, it's, you can see why he's broken it down. It's an easy way to tell these stories, and you know, that, you know, makes it accessible to kids. That might be why you might find it variable in its quality.
That's a decent enough comeback to my criticism. But picking up on that point, Michael, about the fact that it is episodic and it is almost like lots of stories in one, that leads me to the question of, what's your favourite bit? Like, because it is a story of bits, so which bit really kind of jumped out to you?
Yeah, I quite like the spontaneity of it, not really knowing what's going to happen next. But for me, I liked it when you really got the heroic qualities of Bilbo coming through, is when he was the one who had to save the hobbits from the spiders. The dwarves began to appreciate having Bilbo on the journey with them, as before he was just kind of the tag-along sort of person who couldn't fight, couldn't do this, couldn't do that. So
can I interject at this point, because I think that the only reason he can do that is because he's got the ring. My problem with rereading The Hobbit, which I'd completely forgotten about, is that Bilbo is pretty useless until he gets the ring. And he gets the ring, and of course he can become invisible. Well, I could do a lot of things if I could become invisible. I think it gives him an extra dimension, obviously, which I'm not so sure he'd have been quite so popular and quite so much of a hero without the ring.
Well, see, having been the one who kind of was quick to criticise it, I'm not sure about that because, okay, I think that having the ring, it sort of allows him to access a side of his character that hadn't really flourished. But it's not just the fact that he has the ring that then allows him to succeed, because he does grow in bravery and he does grow in boldness. By the end, he's the one who is saying, this is what we have to do. Guys, stop arguing. I'm going to try and find a solution here. I don't know. Now I found myself on the other side of the argument.
Juliet, can you remember what you told me you thought about Bilbo when we first started talking about this?
I thought he was annoying because he has no depth more than his stomach. I mean, he's always thinking, I want to be at home eating my grain cakes. I'm not even sure. I don't want to go to this dragon. Yeah. I know he's forced into it, but everyone tells us to resist peer pressure. I'm not sure what to do. He's not really a role model.
And he is bullied by the dwarves most
yes,
of the time.
Yes, he is bullied by the dwarves.
Because probably hobbits are the only people dwarves can bully in terms
because
of size.
Because they're smaller than yeah. Exactly.
Make the most of it.
I guess Tolkien was doing something about kind of the English character as well, with the character of Bilbo and with the hobbits as well. The person who just doesn't want to be interrupted, you know, that very kind of stereotypical middle-class English person who just likes a cup of tea and some peace and quiet. And in a way, the Shire is kind of an homage to that lifestyle, isn't it? You know, like, yeah. Tolkien kind of loves that, but because he's almost kind of saying, this kind of person actually has everything that you need for life. So there you go, Juliet. Maybe you should be more like Bilbo. Okay, so Rachel, just to come back to you for a second then, how, and in fact, Michael and Juliet, you can come in on this as well. I'm interested, how does the tone and sort of style that Tolkien writes in compare to like young adult fiction today?
I read The Inheritance Cycle by Christopher Paolini recently. Right. And I have to say, I think that was much better than The Hobbit. I think it was a world you could more get into. I felt I could relate to Aragorn as well, and his bond with Sophia is he's deep, unlike Bilbo. He's just like, I want grain cakes, I want to be at home. I want a cup of tea.
So you really feel there's not that much to Bilbo?
No.
And the last young adult fantasy novel that I read, of course, was The Hunger Games. Mm. And I mean, Katniss Everdeen is the heroine for the teenagers. I think she's wonderful. I think Katniss is great.
Can I, yes. Speaking as not a young adult. Are we not comparing apples with oranges here? Because sure, I think The Hobbit's for a younger audience than actually a young adult.
Okay.
Do you not think? I think Lord of the Rings is more of a young adult novel than The Hobbit. You know, The Hobbit doesn't have that internal, like, they don't have the internal lives that your average young adult kind of heroine or hero will have these days. But you do get that in Lord of the Rings. The Hobbit, it's a sketch. It's quite superficial. It's very much from one action sequence to another. Not anything really much deeper than that, and if it does it get that way, it's very superficially handled. So I don't think it's a young adult novel by any stretch.
I think the problem with that is that a lot of people who pre-teenage will have problem with the language. It's very cleverly written and it's got a lot of vocabulary in it that it's not often used. It is unusual. Pupils come into my school and Diary of a Wimpy Kid is what they're reading. You know, you'd have to push yourself quite a bit pre-10, yeah. I think, to really get it.
What about you, Michael? Like, if we hadn't been talking about it on this podcast and asking you to come along, is it a book that you would pick up and read, or would you consider it as that's for a younger reader than me?
I think I did read it back when I was, I think, first year at high school. Comparing it to when I read it just recently, I wouldn't say I was as gripped last time as I was this time. So maybe being slightly older gives you some kind of edge in reading it.
So it was more, you got more out of it this time?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, even reading it, a lot of it didn't come back to me because maybe I didn't pick it up back when I read it the first time round. So
what I think is really impressive about Tolkien storytelling and thinking about a younger audience as well is that a lot of the scenes do go to quite dark places. But it's like you said, Ed, he does it in a way where you have to fill in the details. And as an older reader, you can do that. Like that battle at the end, you can appreciate that that's horrific. He was writing from the experience of someone who'd been involved in the First World War. You can feel that in it, but it's not overbearing in a way that a younger reader would be traumatized or
it would be inappropriate. That's impressive. And similarly, the sequence which I think stood out to me as being particularly dark in tone is the kind of riddles in the dark sequence with Gollum. That really jumped out to me as a kind of, I'm not sure what's going to happen now. I felt a bit worried for Bilbo for the first time, because a lot of the time, Tolkien kind of says, he'll reassure you before something's happened, and he'll go, it was all okay in the end, by the way. Let's find out how it became okay. You know. But in that sequence, that doesn't happen.
Well, I mean, that sequence is probably my favorite one as well. It's a very interesting sequence because, again, thanks to the wonders of Wikipedia, I will not claim personal knowledge of this. I know. It is the sequence which Tolkien went back and rewrote the most whenever he revised it when he started working on Lord of the Rings, and he basically developed the whole story of the ring and its power and Gollum's role and all this. He went back and changed that scene the most. And of all the scenes and all the chapters in The Hobbit, it's the one which does feel like it's been refined and edited and sharpened, because it obviously is springboard for Lord of the Rings from that point on. And I think it really benefits from that. I think it benefits from Tolkien coming back, maybe with a more kind of, again, confident eye and really, you know, deepening and darkening that scene. Because apparently in the original draft, the first edition, Gollum is nowhere near as aggressive towards Bilbo as he is in the versions we all read today. Apparently they parted on relatively amicable terms, as opposed to, you know, threat, you know, cursing him to the heavens. Yeah. You know, yeah.
The funny thing about that, of course, because the last thing that Gollum says is, "We hates it, thief Baggins." Yeah. And if that just brings back the films, doesn't it? Because that echoes throughout the Lord of the Rings films. Yeah. And I thought that was great reading that with the hindsight of knowing the films as well as we do.
I have to admit, I wasn't too worried for Bilbo because I was too busy trying to solve the riddles myself.
Could you, out of interest?
Well, the one about fish, I could.
Fish one I got.
Fish yes, one I got. I got a couple of others as well, but I was too busy trying to solve them. I was thinking, Mom, what's this one?
Yeah.
The trick with all those, any kind of riddles in those kind of things, is at least one of them, the answers will be time.
Oh, always.
Always. It's like a Sunday school question. It's like Jesus is the answer to any question in Sunday school. Time to any ancient riddle.
Okay, so slightly connected to riddles, although the riddles are quite fun and like play an important part in the plot. But guys, what about the songs? Did you skip them? Did you read them?
I didn't read them in depth, no, because I just find them annoying after like the first two verses. So I just kind of skipped them and went to the next bit. I thought, I tried to imagine what kind of tunes they would go to. Then I thought, no, I'm not a musician. I'm going to skip it.
At the beginning of the book, I felt that there was no kind of knowledge that I could put towards what they were actually talking about. But once the story started coming together, and the lyrics of the song started kind of making sense, and you could see, like, as they're going back to where Bilbo came from,
the Shire.
Yeah, and it was like, yeah, we've been over mountains, we've done this, we've done that. It all kind of, it was quite nice, kind of summary of events. It was
in your head. So, Ed, you've written about songs in The Hobbit. Tell us your perspective.
They're not, don't worry, it's not like out of a fond place. Essentially, you know, I think Tolkien has a lot to answer for, especially when it comes to, you know, 70s musical output. You know, basically these songs are like Led Zeppelin songs at their worst. It's like, you know, they're like a Jeff Wayne concept album inside a book. They're just, I just find them, I can see their purpose and I can see why I can understand and sympathize with people who like them, but I just kind of skip over them. I just find they don't really add anything to it. Like dwarf karaoke is all well and good, but it's not really doing anything for me. And even more so in Lord of the Rings, where you've got screeds of it, and I can see it's deepening the world and the mythology, and that's wonderful. But it's, in many ways, actually, if you're finding the reading quite laborious, it's quite nice when you come across the songs. Like, oh, brilliant. I can just give over these two pages and stuff.
Rachel, you're kind of seething there.
Of course I'm seething.
Do you love, have you got War of the Worlds? Are you a big fan
I
of
haven't
that?
Got War of the Worlds. What I'm thinking of is the Rush album from 1976. Got a song on it called Rivendell.
The Wrath of Smaug. Yeah.
I think there's a space for it.
I rest my case. A 1978 Rush song. That's a kid should not be exposed to this.
Kids should be exposed to this. It's part of our musical culture. It's disappeared, unfortunately. I love the songs. I try to sing. I don't try to sing. What I do is I go back to the classic prog rock albums I had in the 70s, and I think of the longest guitar solo I possibly can, and I put the music above that with a couple of shots of Legolas in the distance, and it works.
Yeah, but the thing is, because The Hobbit is so, it's so fun and episodic and short and punchy, the songs are the equivalent of having like a great Motown single interspersed with widdly 13 minute long guitar solos. You know, that, they're that incongruous for myself. I just, I have no time for them.
This is one of those situations where you had to be there.
Can I just say something about the readership of The Lord of the Rings when I grew up with it? There weren't many girls who read The Lord of the Rings. I mean, I would say that the demographic, people who read The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit in the 70s, was predominantly male. And there was a lot of kind of rock anthems. There was a rock anthemic kind of thing about it. We were the kind of guys who did bang our heads at Led Zeppelin concerts. And I mean, I think to me, that was the other thing it brought back, actually, funnily enough. It brought back that Rush album.
Talking about, I just wanted to throw this in because this really struck me as talking about things that perhaps don't need to be in the book. And I realise that there's other views are available. Why on earth are there so many dwarves in the party? Yeah. Like, I mean, seriously, it seemed to me that at max, four of them actually do anything that is relevant to the story. I haven't counted the number of them, but I mean, if you think about it, like there's 13, what is the point of all those dwarves being in that group?
I think it's maybe an excuse just to put Bilbo into the actual thing, 13 is supposed to be an unlucky number and stuff, and they want a 14th member of the party. So I think that's just an excuse.
Or there's the slightly laboured comedic kind of entry of them all at his house at the start.
Right.
Which only works if you've got loads of them coming in.
Yeah, exactly. You know, in the Keystone Cops kind of way.
Yeah.
And again, the when they all kind of come out of the clearing at Bjorn's house as well. Yeah, so maybe he kind of wrote these scenes and just was committed to them so much that he had, again, maybe he's kind of going for the, you know, Santa's reindeer kind of riff, kind of right, prancer dancer, kind of Fido Dido, whatever the rest.
Billy and Killy.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Ori Glory, Glowin and Owen, Beefa, Bofa, Bomba, Balin, Dwaylin, and Thorin. Is
that's the B side of one of the Rush songs.
Can I just say one thing? Yeah, yeah. We've talked about what there's too many of.
Yeah.
Has anybody else noticed what there's none of in The Hobbit?
Women.
In fact, that's something that Peter Jackson is slightly correcting in his film version.
That's a surprise.
Let's talk about the film version for a minute, because he's got Galadriel turning up in The Hobbit. So let's talk briefly about the film version. I mean, who's planning on going to see it? Having read the book?
Yeah,
we are.
Yes.
But what do we think about the expansion that is going on? Rachel, you're kind of not looking too pleased about that?
I think it's a great book. And I think the other thing that I had forgotten is how much action there is in it, really. I mean, it's like you said, it's episodic, adventure after adventure. Yeah. But I still think you'd have a lot of problems putting it into three films. My worry is there's going to be extra stuff. If there is a love interest for Bilbo, I am going to get seriously angry.
Yeah, well, see, initially, whenever I heard it was going to be a trilogy, I was a bit kind of puzzled because, as I said at the very start, it's quite a slim novel with a big kind of world inside of it. But actually, rereading it as I did last night, it does make a bit more sense. It's actually quite good fun to try and work out where the breaks would be in the trilogy. But again, to go back again to the climactic battle, I mean, that's handled in about 10 pages. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine Peter Jackson making a good 40 or 50 minutes out of that, you know?
Yeah.
And again, because it's very much like a sketch. I mean, Polly probably might know more about this, but what is the translation of, you know, what one page is on a screenplay to screen time?
It's about one page per minute.
If you equate, I mean, obviously The Hobbit's not a complete kind of dialogue, but it's obviously more than that. It's describing lots of action. I think there is enough in this. And also because I can see why he went to a trilogy, because Tolkien fans are so annoyed if you ever take anything out like Tom Bombadil in the Lord of the Rings, that I think he would be loath to have left anything out of The Hobbit. And conceivably, you could have left actually several chapters out of it, and it would still have made a completely coherent and enjoyable film or two films. But I think he's going to get everything in. And I don't think each film's going to be 3 hours long like Lord of the Rings, because I don't think there's any need for that. So I think it's actually, it makes sense now on rereading.
Juliet, what would you think of the prospect of three movies out of this one book?
I find it annoying in like films when they like cut like loads of stuff out, but I find it annoying if they make too much of stuff, because it just goes on forever. I mean, a lot of time spent on kind of like descriptions, and I mean, I feel if we spend ages on that, it's not be interesting. But I'm sure if you added more stuff into it, it might work. I'm not sure if you can make three films out of one small volume.
Yeah, well, the thing is, there is a lot of other texts, aren't there, around various notes. Like, I don't really know my Tolkien, so I'm kind of wading into an area that I don't know about. From what I've heard, he's got notes about the world where they can interpret, this happened there. And, like, at the end of The Hobbit, they talk about where Gandalf has been for the whole story. Mm. So you can see that there's a space there where you can go, let's tell that story as well. So I think, you know, that there could be grounds for it. But still, having read it, I'm kind of like, three movies?
And there's also room to expand characters. Like, for example, the Bard, who kind of rocks up at the end and pretty much saves the day.
Yeah.
And it is very much the kind of proto-Aragon kind of character.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, all you know about him is grim-faced and grim-voiced.
Yeah.
And you get told that booze. But that's really it. That's all you know about his character. And he's really good with an arrow. And he used to be a king in a far-off land, in a very Aragorn kind of style. So, you know, you could see, like, the third film, for example, I think pretty much be all about him, and him be the hero of that third film, and expand him and his backstory. And I think, because we were chatting beforehand, I mean, Tolkien wrote this whole kind of, like, almost like history of Middle-earth, is it? And
the Silmarillion.
So I think that'll be plundered to kind of fill in a lot of the mythology and backstory of the trilogy of The Hobbit.
Okay, so, Michael, sum this up for us. We're going to come to the end of this, but if a friend of yours was like, oh, The Hobbit, is it any good? Should I read it? What would your pitch be?
If they're looking for something with a lot of action, adventure, I'd definitely want to go for. Definitely keeps you gripped, keeps you going. It's a good page turner. Maybe not so much depth as in getting to know characters. I wouldn't say there's a lot of characters as well. So it keeps you on your toes. But yeah, good read. Yeah.
Well, those are our thoughts on The Hobbit. And we'd love to hear what your take on the book is, so please get in touch with us at Facebook and Twitter. Just search Scottish BK Trust, all one word, and you'll find us. You can also comment directly on the podcast page at scottishbooktrust.com/booktalk. We look forward to your comments. That's almost all from Book Talk this month, but before we go, I want to ask each of my guests for a recommendation of one great book that they've read this year.
Admittedly, I'm not the most compulsive of readers, but however, I have read this year Perks of Being a Wallflower, modern kind of teenage kind of novel. Good, a lot of good characters in there, you felt a lot of people could relate to them, I'd imagine. So I definitely recommend that.
Rachel, how about you?
My book I'm going to recommend is The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, which is a modern interpretation of the love story between Achilles and Patroclus that took place at the Trojan War. The woman who wrote it, Madeline Miller, is a classical scholar herself. It's Homeric. It sounds like Homer, it reads like Homer, but it also reads like a modern book. It is fantastic. I couldn't put it down, even though everybody knows what happens, and even though it doesn't even include the bit about the Trojan horse. It's just a wonderful, wonderful book.
Brilliant. Thanks. Ed?
One of my favourites this year is that I read this year was Skippy Dies by Paul Murray, which is about teenagers in a Dublin private school, and it's very long, and it could definitely do with an edit, but again, it's very episodic but wonderful, and deals with the kind of the pangs and the heartbreak and the elation of being, you know, in your late teens, wondering what to do with your life and wondering why that girl doesn't fancy you and why you're being bullied. And just kind of, it has a kind of a magical realistic quality in places, as well as kind of social realistic as well. And it's great and it's wonderful. And Skippy does die at the very start. And so his death casts a pall over the whole book, and it's very sad as well. And bittersweet. It's a bittersweet book. It's great.
I've heard very good things about that. Thanks for that. And Juliet, to come to you last.
I think I'd recommend The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. I've not actually seen the film yet, but Katniss has depth, unlike Bilbo, who's depth. It's centred around kind of hunger and stuff, but Bilbo's always talking, I want grain cakes, and she's like, no, I must feed my family. See, it goes beyond her and her stomach. She thinks she has to feed her family, and her family's her biggest worry. And you're saying, I've read the trilogy in about a week and I loved it. That's, I couldn't fit it down.
And if you want more recommendations and thoughts from me on books that are good, you can listen to any of the past episodes of the Book Talk podcast, which you'll find on scottishbooktrust.com. So, great picks, everyone. Thanks to you all. Ed McCracken, where can people find more of your bookish ponderings?
They can find it on bookrat.com, home to some of the finest, wittiest, funniest, informed kind of musings on all things books on the internet.
Thank you very much. And Rachel McCabe, it's been a pleasure, as always. And thanks very much to you two, Michael and Juliet. Thanks for coming on Book Talk. Don't forget to catch the next edition of our sister podcast, Bookmarked, featuring Ryan Van Winkle with interviews, news and features from the world of books, available in early January from scottishbooktrust.com and iTunes. For Scottish Book Trust, I'm Paul Gallagher. Happy Christmas. Book Talk is produced by Colin Fraser, with music by Sam Gallagher.